people say, oh, do you remember that TV show from the 90s? And I'm like, no, because I wasn't watching TV in the 90s. I wasn't home.
Hello, my name's Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So, if you have ever wondered what New York City in the 90s was like, then I think that this week's episode might just be the one for you. Before mass gentrification, before eye-watering rent hikes, and before, well, all the personality was stamped right out of it, queer nightclubbing in the Big Apple was anarchic, unhinged, and magical. Or so I've heard. And the person that told me all about this is this week's guest, drag superstar, singer-songwriter, and host of the Sherry Vine variety show, Sherry Vine, who was right there, smack dab in the middle of it all. In this episode, we talk all about Sherry moving to NYC from her beloved LA, getting started in drag and figuring out who she was. And Sherry also gives a bit of a flavor of that anarchic magic that used to be found on every street corner. Shall we get into it?
Funny because my entire life, all I ever talked about was living in Los Angeles. And when I'm from Maryland, and I was auditioning for graduate schools to get a master's degree in acting. And I knew I wanted to go to LA, but I auditioned for other schools. And I got into one in Pennsylvania, one in Boston, and one in LA. And I said, oh, I'm going to LA. So it was like my life long dream had come true to go to Los Angeles the first time. Then my best friends from Maryland had all ended up in New York City. They started a theater company. I had started to experiment with drag. And they're like, we need you to come here and be in this play we're writing. You're going to be the leading lady. This was Theater Couture. So I went to New York to do this play and just never left. And the funny thing is that when I told my parents, they weren't shocked about the drag. Like, they were like, oh, that sounds fun. But they were like, so shocked that I left Los Angeles after that's all I had ever talked about. So that's kind of how I ended up in New York. I went to do a play and never left.
How fascinating. Because you are so interwoven. That's not the right word. You as a person so exemplifies New York. So I just made the assumption that that was little queer you's dream to go to New York and take over the city, but you couldn't give a shit about it at first. I should say at first.
No, I mean, I wanted to be a movie star. So, I mean, that was the plan. Uh-huh. And when I was in New York, just starting doing drag, I really fought against it because I was like, this is not what I want to do. This isn't my plan. This isn't my plan. And my roommate at the time, my best friend Douglas, was like, why are you fighting this? And so once I kind of let go and embraced it, this theater company took off. It was really big in the 90s in New York City, and I was working, and it was just really an amazing, great, crazy time. And I really felt in my heart that I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. And then it was very easy to let go of this. I'm going to be a movie star. I have to be a movie star because I felt that I was doing what I was supposed to do.
Okay, but just so I'm clear, New York was never in the plan. Drag was never in the plan.
No way. No.
Wow. Okay. Oh, how interesting. So then how did you come to drag then if it was never in the plan?
Well, in graduate school, I went to USC, the University of Southern California, and we had a guest director this one semester named Anna Deavere Smith, who's an amazing actress. And part of this project was spending time with three real people that were completely different and creating a work around that. So I was with this very kind of, well, this heterosexual businessman and this kind of nerdy art director who actually worked on Pee-wee's Playhouse and this drag queen in West Hollywood. And when I did the drag part of this project, Annie DeVere Smith pulled me aside and she was like, you should explore that. And so I was like, oh.
So she didn't ask you to explore the heterosexual businessman?
No. So I just kind of started doing drag just for fun. I didn't have any intention of it being a career.
And how has Sherry evolved? Like, did she just come out fully formed or?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, it's been 32 years now. But the biggest kind of transformation was early on. I always felt like I had to look funny to be funny. And so when I first started, it was not about looking, quote unquote, pretty or presenting feminine at all. Like, I didn't wear breasts. I didn't care about my, if you could see my beard, kind of trashy drag, which is nothing against that. But I was then in New York City at this period, hanging out with Mistress Formica, Candace Kane, Lena, all these gorgeous performers. And I was like, I want to be pretty. And so I kind of started to experiment with like a look and really defining the character. I was like, okay, Sherry Vine is this kind of showgirl, Vegas showgirl, but a little tattered. Like I always said, my look was Barbie on crack. And so I started to kind of experiment that. I had a lot of friends in the East Village who were like, don't cross over, don't cross over. And I was like, I'm not doing it because of peer pressure. I want to explore creating this character and having a look. So once that kind of established that, it has not evolved very much. Certainly in the past 25 years, it has not evolved a lot. It's like, show the legs, a little trashy, blonde. I'm always, always, always blonde. Once had a really good friend of mine in Barcelona where I used to work every summer, who every night had a different look. And she was like, oh my God, don't you get tired? Why do you always have to be blonde? Don't you get tired of that? And I was like, no, I want to walk into a place and have people know who I am. You know, it's like I'm trying to create a look and a brand. So the Sherry Vine you see now is pretty much not evolved, like I said, in like 25. Maybe it's gotten more refined or something. But I think the biggest thing is just kind of really honing in on what you do well that could be different than what other people are doing and exploiting that.
That's a good plan. Okay, so let's see if I've got this right. So you started drag in university whilst you were in LA, and then your friends who were setting up a theater company in New York who knew about your drag character were like, come over here and get involved in this. And that's how you ended up in New York City.
Yeah. He wrote a play and he was like, I want you to play the mother.
Boom. And is that like a good thing to hear or a bad thing to hear?
Oh, I mean, it was hilarious. I don't think it was about the age. The daughter was like 7 or whatever. So it was a parody of The Bad Seed. And so, yeah, it was fine.
And so you cross the country, you end up in New York. Do you remember what that felt like? What are the lingering memories from those days?
Well, it was super exciting because, in my opinion, New York in the early 90s was just, for nightlife, was amazing. I mean, I know that there are other issues about safety, and Times Square at the time was like horrifying, but the nightlife was really exciting. And I was getting to meet and work with these drag icons that, this was before the internet, you know, you do your homework. I knew who Joey Arias was, Lady Bunny, RuPaul, Sister Dimension. So it was like this really, it was very exciting. And literally every single night of the week, there were 5 different things to do. I was having fun. I was having a lot of fun.
And how much of that fun was you in boy mode and how much of that fun was you in drag mode?
It was really both. The drag just kind of like really exploded and took off for me. It was kind of like the right place at the right time. I mean, it was really exciting there were a million different places to perform. Like I said, we had Squeeze Box, where it was like drag queens singing live with a rock band. We had Jackie 60, which was like every week a different theme. They're like, this week do Jacques Brel. This week you're going to be this person. And so it was fulfilling me as an actor and a performer and fun. And then on the boy side, I was having a blast. I mean, to be honest, at that late 80s and early 90s in West Hollywood, I was so skinny. That, I mean, nobody would touch me. And to get to New York, it was just like a very different world.
Well, let's explore that. Well, is that because like you hadn't changed, but they were more interested in skinny young things than in LA, or?
Well, you have to think about the time and what was going on at that time. And someone who was just like 120 pounds looked like they had, you know, a week to live in their minds. So, yeah, that's what it was about.
So none of that was about the confidence that you were able to tap into through drag that you then parlayed into non-drag?
No. I didn't really have confidence in how I looked, certainly out of drag, until I got to New York.
So what was different in New York? And just
I'm not sure. I just think that West Hollywood, especially at that time, was so obsessed with like muscle boys. But in New York, it just was so much more diversity. And yeah, I think my sexual awakening happened to New York when I got there.
Oh, let's find out more about the sexual awakening. So what was it like then to go from viewing yourself as undesirable through other people's eyes to suddenly being like, oh, I might be kind of hot?
It was fun. It was really fun.
So you didn't overthink it then. You're not like me who would be like, why is this happening? What's going on?
No, I just was like, yay, let's go. Yeah, I was whoring it up. I had a good time.
Oh, man after my own heart. So, is it too intrusive? No, yes. No, we don't really want to know about your whoring activities in the early 90s, do we?
Honey, I sing about it. It's my act. So there's no secret about any of it.
How did you know you were a whore? Can we have a chat about something you said earlier struck me? Like, you said you were an actor, which I love hearing from you. I love the confidence in the way that you said that. Sorry, I'm coming across a little patronizing in what I'm saying. You said, I am an actor. And I think it's changed over the years, but there's quite a lot of stigma attached to drag in that, like, you know, you're just getting on stage and showing off and being loud and being abrasive. Mm-hmm. Have you ever, like, come up against that, your identity as an actor and the way people perceive you because you are known for drag?
Oh, yeah, for sure, 100%. Certainly, when I started, drag was still a fringe art form. It was not considered legitimate art form. And I think it's different in the UK. I mean, you've always kind of had it. And I think that kind of cabaret culture is a bit more legitimized, and it was not, than it is in the United States. And certainly with drag, like I said, most of the audience was gay men. It was very fringe. New York City was a little different because it was New York City. So what was ever cool, like Bardot, we get every celebrity you can ever name would have had been there. And it was kind of different. And Squeeze Box, lots of amazing, like rock stars would come. It was always made very clear that this is a gay bar and you're welcome here to our gay party, which I loved. But like I said, it was not a legitimized art form. And RuPaul kind of broke through that with Supermodel. And then certainly now with Drag Race, it really has legitimized drag as an art form and a commodity, and there could be money made. And so now there's like movies and TV show parts, and these queens go on tour and they're making tons, shitload of money. And the audience, it's like mostly not gay men. So it's definitely changed how drag is perceived and accepted.
Mm-hmm. But then so going back to you starting and establishing yourself in that space, I guess the question I'm asking is, did you ever tussle with that? Because you also said, I was doing what I loved, I was making money, it was like a legitimate career. But that very young version of you had an idea of who they would be as an actor in Hollywood. And did you ever kind of feel a bit conflicted about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned that, like, not for long. Only in the very beginning, I just was like, no, I'm not going to be a drag queen. I'm going to be a movie star. And so, but once I let go of that and accepted it, like, okay, let me just see what this brings me. I'm making money performing in drag, and it's more fun than waiting tables. And been given this gift of this very amazing theater company that people, there's a demand for what we were doing, and I get to be the star. So I don't have to go and audition to be in the chorus of a road show. There's someone writing a play for me and someone directing it in costume. Like, we had this team that just organically came together. And I'm like, how can I ignore that as a sign, a gift from the universe that this is what you're supposed to be doing? So once I did accept that and embrace that, then it was just like really easy. And like I said, I felt fulfilled as an actor because we had the theater company and I was doing these other things.
I guess, yeah, I'm just thinking a lot about the boxes we're encouraged to put ourselves into when we're children and how stifling that can be.
Well, you know, this is part of evolving as you grow older. There's lots of things that you, like, at this point, I can let go of the dream of being a pop star. Hi, dear. No, that's not going to happen. So you kind of evolve.
Wait, hang on. Didn't you just release a single like a few months ago?
Yes. I mean, look, I literally, when I was 5, 6 years old, would sit and watch the Carol Burnett show and be like, that's what I want to do one day. And the whole goal of my whole life, even before drag, was to do TV and movies. And now I am. So it's like, whatever. It's like I have this costume and as Sherry Vine. So what? I'm literally doing the things that I dreamed of doing when I was a little kid. I mean, I'm so lucky.
Yeah, yeah. And I absolutely agree. And I think that is wonderful. And I think that we shouldn't put ourselves in boxes and that we should evolve and should embrace opportunities as they're presented to us. But I just also think people are assholes, and sometimes you overthink things because you're anticipating them being assholes.
Yeah.
So then let's go back and talk more about what was happening in your life at that time. So your career was booming when you moved to New York, and you were getting a lot of dick, let's say. What else was going on in your life at that time?
I mean, as much as the nightlife and everything was so fun and exciting, which it was great. There was, you know, obviously the dark, tragic side of living in New York City in the 90s, certainly the early to mid 90s, which is AIDS, and losing friends left and right, including my best friend who I started this theater company with, Douglas, in 95.
Oh.
So trying to navigate all of that, and I did a lot of stuff with ACT UP, the March in Washington. There was a lot going on. And then, oh my gosh, getting into the late 90s, early 2000, before 9/11, Giuliani trying to, well, successfully destroying New York City nightlife. I was like, ugh, that was the end of that era.
This is a really broad, wide question, and I'm not sure how you would answer it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What was it like living in that era of HIV before meds, before we knew enough about the virus?
Well, I mean, it's kind of obvious. It was scary and it was sad. And I think New York City certainly was just so there's so much going on that you've never felt alone. You just was like, okay, we're all in this together and we're going to get through it. And we just have to keep going and celebrating life mm-hmm. and celebrating the people that we lost. And there really was this feeling. I don't think that certainly the people that I knew in New York, we weren't sitting at home in the dark, just being like scared or whatever. It's like, no, fuck you, AIDS. We're going to do this show and we're going to go do this and I'm going to go into this dark room and suck a dick or whatever.
Feels like that should be a bumper sticker slogan or something. I grew up in a world, I don't remember a time like before AIDS, and I grew up in a world where it was just like drilled into you, like do not have sex with strangers. You know, if you are going to have sex with strangers, make sure you wear 27 condoms, and like don't trust them. They're like, strangers are bad people. And I think that really robbed me of intimacy. Like there right. was always this voice in the back of my head during any moments of intimacy of like, oh, are you thinking of this? Oh, are you thinking of this? Are you thinking of this? And you couldn't give yourself up to the moment. I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
Well, no, I mean, anyone who kind of lived through that would agree with that. It makes sense completely.
It's hard to know whether I've come out the other end or not.
And I remember being so terrified. I mean, I went through all of college really without having sex like those years.
What a waste of a degree.
I know. I was so terrified. And I was living in LA then. And when I got to New York, I was like, oh, and I think it was more, there was more education of like what they would consider safe and unsafe, mm-hmm, risky, mm-hmm, and all of that, the categories. And I was like, oh, okay, well, these are the things that I'm going to do. I'm making an adult decision to do these things and I'm not going to do these other things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I could have lots of intimacy, however you want to define that. And
well, now tell us, how do you define that?
Well, touching is being intimate. So there was lots of ways to be intimate without, you know, having unprotected anal sex. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, it's not a judgment. I mean, you got to watch every single thing you say so carefully these days. That's not a judgment at all. And people choose to do that now. Whatever. Great. Okay. You're an adult. And I still can't, because of that lingering fear all this time later of the trauma, PST, of living through AIDS, of like, would never...
Oh, wow.
And that's just me. Some people be like, you're slut-shaming. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so not. I'm just like...
But so let me understand this. So is it that you've tried to do it and there's just a barrier?
I wouldn't even try. Or... No.
You wouldn't even try? Uh-uh. Wow.
I had a boyfriend for 10 years and I was like, it will never happen. Don't even think about it.
Ah. And that's never wavered?
No, and I just don't feel like I don't have any need to. It's like it doesn't change how I'm going to enjoy it at all. So that's the other part, like, get over it. I don't like wearing condoms. Well, tough shit. If you want to fuck me, put on a condom.
Oh, wait, okay, I've misunderstood. So you are having anal sex, you're just using a condom?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I thought you were saying you just don't have anal.
Oh, my God. Hope this doesn't make it to my mother.
Hi, Mom.
No, for sure. That has lingered since then. That's something that I just can't let go of.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to me how, like, the whole kind of health campaign around, like, AIDS and HIV was basically just like, let's scare the fuck out of people. And I don't know why I'm laughing, sorry. Let's scare the fuck out of people by like making this, like, catastrophizing if you get like a drop of semen in your mouth and like making them feel as though they're going to die in a week's time. Like how successful that campaign was and just all the lingering impacts of that. And I sometimes feel like I see younger people who have only really ever known Prep and Pep in their adult lives, who I perceive to be so carefree and relaxed about those things, which is wonderful. But there's also a bit of me that's like, damn it, why didn't I get that?
Yeah, it's a hard conversation. I mean, I'm glad that there are choices. And like I said, it's hard to say anything without someone misinterpreting it. So I'm only can speak for myself and I can only make choices for me. And I'm not on PrEP or anything because, like I said, I wouldn't get fucked without a condom. So I think if I was in a relationship with someone who was positive or whatever, then maybe I would consider it just as a safety net. I don't know. And like I said, I don't know necessarily the status of everyone that I might hook up with, because you kind of, you're hooking up with someone you don't know, then you don't really know whether, no matter what they say. So I just kind of don't even take any chances.
How did we get here? Oh yeah, HIV in the 90s, growing
the 90s, yeah,
living the 90s, yeah. And like, really, this conversation's about New York nightlife in the 90s before over-gentrification. Is over-gentrification a term? Before gentrification and before all of the uniqueness and personality was stamped out of it.
Mm-hmm.
How could you get someone who's never experienced that to understand what that chaos and magic was like?
It's really hard. I mean, that's another example of in my day, because yeah, it's just not the same place anymore. It's kind of like a suburb of Connecticut now. But, and then certainly, like I said with Giuliani, there was a period where it's like, you can't dance.
No.
Are we? Yes. That was his whole thing. There's an old law from the 1920s prohibition of you can't dance where you serve alcohol. And that's what Giuliani was enforcing. And so the fire department would come to gay bars and turn the lights on and turn the music off and close the place down for the night and find the bar for having dancing. So then they had to have security people walk around and tell people, can't dance. And I'm like, are we in fucking Footloose or New York City?
Wow. I didn't know that. So how long did that go on for?
That went on for a while. Lots of it completely destroyed and then changed New York nightlife to where now it's just like, it's not the same.
Bland.
So I tell people, like, go to Berlin, and that's what New York City was like in the 90s.
About as cold as well in winter. Okay, so but we didn't really quite boil it down to its essence, though. What does it feel like to be in a space in early 90s New York before it was ruined?
Oh, hyperstimulation. There was just so much going on. And like I said, I don't want to downplay the dark side, but there was a kind of unified, we're not going to let that kill us, metaphorically speaking, and literally. It just had this energy and this pace, and it was like, people say, oh, do you remember that TV show from the 90s? And I'm like, no, because I wasn't watching TV in the 90s. I wasn't home. And I'm not even kidding. There are shows that I've never seen one episode of because I'm like, no. We weren't sitting at home in the 90s in New York City watching TV. We were out every fucking night. There was just so much. And you've had that feeling of like, oh, well, if I don't go to Sugar Babies on this Monday night, I'm going to miss something, so I better go. I mean, we were out every single 7 nights a week.
Wow. How did your knees handle that?
Well, I'm getting paid back for it now, actually, with my knees.
What do you think, I mean, we've skirted around this a lot, we've talked a lot about this, but what do you think New York lost as a result of all of those changes?
Well, everything, it pushed out a lot of artists because it just became impossible to make a living. Like, I'd get in drag and show up at the Cock to do a show where I was going to get paid. That's how I made my living. And then the fire department comes to turn the lights on and there's like no show, you don't get paid.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. So for DJs and performers and artists, it pushed out. And then the rents just skyrocketed so much that, you know, it's really hard to be an artist and live in New York City. Most people live, I guess, outside of Manhattan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then it just changed everything, you know. Then you'd have, like, people complaining, oh, that bar, the noise is too... And it's like, move to Connecticut. Fuck off. Move to Jersey City. This is Manhattan. Can't we have in this huge United States one little tiny dot... And Giuliani was like, no, you can't. So fuck him. I hate to get joy from someone, Schadenfreude. I hate to get joy from someone else's demise, but fuck him. I'm watching him just like all these things happening now. And it's like, I have zero sympathy for that man.
Hear, hear. So you got to experience it. You got to live that magic of that time. How do you think it shaped who you are?
I mean, in many ways, it's kind of like the right... I was, you know, in my 20s, and so it was great. I think if I moved to New York now at this age and it was like that, I wouldn't benefit from it in the same way because I don't go out and I don't carry on like that at all. So I'm just glad that I was there at that time, at that age, and all the pieces just kind of fell into place. And I think it's shaped me. Certainly, I've got, like I mentioned before, got to experiment and explore who Sherry Vine is and what I was going to do and kind of hone that craft. I mean, there aren't that many places anymore where you can have that opportunity. If you're performing every single night of the week, you're like, well, what I did on Tuesday was a flop, but here I am on Wednesday and people are loving it. So, okay, don't do that and let's do this. So you just got to really experiment and explore. I don't know if younger drag queens get a chance to do that as much.
Oh, that's interesting. Especially because we've talked about the boom in drag and people's understanding and appreciation of it as an art form. I would think that that meant that there would be more opportunities.
No, I think there's also a pressure now of like, you have to kill it the minute, you know, like these young queens come in and do a show in New York and like, you have to kill it or, you know, oh, you didn't pack the place tonight? Well, then we're going to pull a plug on your show. We were given like, I remember when Barracuda opened and all, and the owners were like, don't worry, it might take a year to build an audience. And now you get like week, you know?
And do you think that that's also changed people's approach to experimenting? That was a very leading question, sorry.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think there's a lot of factors. I think that people are less brave to experiment. And look, no one wants to fail, but I certainly... was not scared of it. I mean, it's like, it's how you learn. And also feel like with Drag Race, there's now an expectation of what, you know, there's a lot of new drag queens that come along like, oh, I'm going to do what Bianca does. Oh, I'm going to do what Trixie does, instead of kind of having the freedom and time to explore and find what you do.
Oh, yeah. That's like the double-edged sword of having people to look up to, right? Like, when you have no one to look up to, you have to forge your own path and then you just go where your instincts tell you.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're always influenced by different people or different things, but copying someone was never the goal.
So do you remember then, and this is a bit of a naff question, like how it felt to watch the city change before your eyes?
Yes, I was kind of devastated at first. I mean, on one hand, as nice as it is to like walk around there and be like, oh, this is so pretty. I miss that sleazy, dirty, sketchy meatpacking district because it was just so fun. Everyone would be at Mother. They would close and everyone would walk down the street to Florent, which was the only like restaurant there at the time that was open 24 hours. And Florent was where at 4 o'clock in the morning, everybody ended up and it was its own scene and world. And that's what I mean. Like it was just like, let's keep the party going. And it was just like it was such a cool time. And I was devastated, like, when they redid the meatpacking district. So, I mean, to be honest, when I walk through there now, I'm like, oh, this is really pretty. But I definitely miss that old meatpacking district.
Yeah, it's really hard to describe the magic of somewhere that looks really ugly and is scuzzy.
It was sketchy. It was pretty sketchy. But boy, was it fun.
So then if we could wrap up by reflecting back on Sherry showing up in New York City, didn't particularly care for the city, hadn't really planned to be doing drag. If you had an opportunity to run into that version of yourself and give any words of advice, what would they be?
Don't doubt yourself. My biggest enemy has been the periods of where I doubt myself.
Doubt your instincts or doubt your talent?
Kind of more of a general doubt. Do people still need another parody about blowjobs? You know, I haven't been on Drag Race. Do people want to see me? That's what I would have said. Certainly back in the 90s, there were lots of stuff where I would doubt myself. But that's what I would say to my younger self. Trust yourself. Trust your instincts. Stop doubting yourself.
And do you need to hear that now as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Should we just like text each other every morning?
Yes, please. That would be very helpful. Yes. I had the conversation with Jackie Beat last night. Last night in her car. We both were just like, oh my God, do people still want to see this? And questioning, and how come sometimes it's so hard to get 80 people to come to a show, what you work so hard on? And it's like, have we exhausted the parody thing? And then we just have to remind ourselves, like, I'll do a show and I can look out and be like, people are laughing their asses off. And I see so many shows where they're not. So don't doubt that gift to be able to make people laugh. And I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying, like, in terms of stop doubting yourself.
No. Hang on. Stop. Pat yourself on the back. Just do it, first of all. And yeah, I think it's learning how to ride that wave, right? Of being like, oh, hello. This feels shit and difficult and I'm not motivated, but it won't be like this forever. So I just need to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I say on stage all the time, I make a joke where I'm trying to sell merchandise and I'm like, okay, I know you bought a ticket, you're buying drinks, and now I'm asking you to buy something. Well, please remember, I've been doing this for 32 years. There's no plan B now, no other skills, nothing to fall back on. Buy a fucking shirt.
Do you have any memories of sleazy NYC, or maybe clubbing from your own scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, I would love to hear all about it, so why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I cannot do it alone. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what you got up to. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Sherry by watching her TV show, The Sherry Vine Variety Show, which is available on Out TV in North America or Fruit TV if you are in the UK. I'm not really sure about any of the other countries. Sorry for leaving you out. You can also find her via her website, sherryvine.com, or following her on Instagram or YouTube, where her handle is Miss Sherry Vine, and that's M-I-S-S. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform, or just tell other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.